morning. Welcome to the Senate Health and Human Services Committee meeting on Friday. Appreciate your attendance here early in the morning. We will try to be stay on time. We're planning to adjourn by 10 a.m. I know some of the members have some things that they need to do back in their districts, and I'm one of them, so we will try to be prompt. I think what we're going to do this morning is pick up where we left off and try to complete that, and then we've got Mr. Hoffman from the department to come and talk a little bit about the numbers. We're preparing a copy of a draft of the forecast numbers for us to look at with respect to that, so we will welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Lauren Coleman, Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Human Services for Continuing Care. We have two proposals left to present to the committee. The first one begins on page 54. And this proposal increases the surcharge for nursing facilities and intermediate care facilities for the developmentally disabled. We would increase the surcharges for these providers in two steps in accordance with federal guidance as to what the what we're allowed to do. The first increase would be on July 1. And then the second increase would be on October 1. On the bottom of the page, it gives you the numbers of what the increases would be and what the result to the bed surcharge per bed would be. In addition, we increase the rate paid to these facilities to approximate, but not predict with exact accuracy, but to approximate their ability to pay the surcharge to the state that's charged. We have been using this mechanism for quite some time now. It was initiated originally in 1991. The last increase, I believe, was in 2003. And so that is the recommendation on this page.
Mr. Coleman, just for the benefit of the committee's understanding of what this your proposal is, a general fund savings on change sheet of $44 million, roughly. So we are putting some kind of a surcharge on what is it based on, number of beds? Is that how that works? Is that the
Mr.
metric?
Chair, that's correct. It's per licensed bed.
And that's an annual surcharge of $635?
Yeah, that's correct.
And then an additional increase of $350. So about a $1,000 increase in a fee to nursing homes phased in, and then in addition to that, there's a phased-in rate increase.
Mr. Chair, that would be correct.
And so, what is the rate increase due to the revenues of the nursing homes? You're saying it's about designed to kind of counteract the surcharge, but just what exactly is the dynamic there?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the impact of the facility is going to vary somewhat, based upon a number of factors. One would be their payer mix. For example, if a facility has a higher portion of Medicare days, Medicare does not adjust their rates to accommodate a surcharge, and so a facility would not be getting a rate increase from that payer source. But the Medicare payment is considerably higher than the Medicaid payment, and so the belief is that the facilities can manage that. Additionally, facilities that would have a low occupancy would not be generating the number of days that would approximate their ability to pay the surcharge. but then they do have the option of delicensing beds and avoiding the surcharge in that manner if they believe that the beds are going to be unoccupied for a considerable amount of time.
Mr. Coleman, is there a does the department have available, or can it get to make available to the committee, what we used to call in the education committee's parlance a run showing the effect of these changes on the individual nursing homes throughout the state? Is it, there might be, this is one of the proposals that members might want to see how it would affect facilities in their district. And I understand that there could be some disparate effect on depending on the population mix in the facility and other factors, and it might be helpful for people to see how that affects individual. Is that something that can
Mr.
be?
Mr. Chair, we can provide that.
Okay. So we're increasing the fee, and then we are increasing the rate that we're reimbursing, and then we're charging a fee, and somehow that saves us money. Is that because we're increasing the fee at a greater rate than the reimbursement that we're providing? Is that essentially the
Mr.
dynamic?
Chair, no. The savings come about because we're increasing the federal participation in the nursing facility or the ICFDD rate, since they're paying 50%.
So when we increase our contribution, we get a matching amount from the federal government?
Which, Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Are there questions from? Thank you.
The last page to present is on page 56, and this involves the MAEPD program. This is a program that Minnesota has been participating in, a nationwide effort to increase employment for people with disabilities. And as we know, health care is an important part of a person's life and does impact an individual's ability to obtain and maintain employment. We've been participating in a grant, been working on this for a number of years, Pathways to Employment, and we have learned that people with disabilities have a strong interest in competitive employment, that there are things that we can do and have been doing to encourage and increase that ability, working with employers, working with other state agencies, DEED, for example. And this proposal continues that trend. The grant with the federal government ends at the end of this calendar year. And so the resources that have been available to manage this program are disappearing. And so you see that we would like to secure a modest amount of resources, a staff person to be able to continue this effective program and continue to help people with disabilities maintain their employment. The proposal increases the premium share and moves us further along the lines of working with people with disabilities similarly to the rest of our populations, asking them to make a contribution to their health insurance. Research has demonstrated that when given that opportunity, when given those various choices of earning more and becoming more self-sufficient, that people will respond positively to that. So the savings really doesn't occur until the next biennium, but because of the nature of the federal funding for this program, we need to get we need to transition in next year.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What is the total amount that is involved in this program current in this current biennium?
Mr. Coleman?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Senator, the total we have approximately 7,200 individuals enrolled, and it generates revenue of a little more than $2 million, about $2.2 million annually.
Senator Newman?
Mr. Coleman, you said it generates revenue. I'm not sure I understand.
Mr. Chair, Senator, Mr. Coleman, we charge premiums. We charge the individuals a premium for their health care coverage, for their medical assistance coverage.
Senator Newman.
Mr. Coleman, what is the amount in the current biennium that is appropriated to provide the grants that you're talking about for purposes of employment?
Mr. Chair, Senator, these individuals are eligible for medical assistance through this program, and they would not otherwise be eligible for medical assistance because of either assets or earnings. So this allows them to buy into the medical assistance program through a premium charge.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Higgins.
I think what Senator Newman is trying to say is, how much does the MAEPD program cost for the biennium,
okay,
the program itself?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Hoffman, welcome to the committee. Thank you for coming.
Chair, Representative Senator Higgins, that's a complicated question.
Mr. Hoffman, could I encourage you to bring the microphone close so we can catch you on the recording? Thank you.
Of the 6,000 or 7,000 people on this program, most of them would be on medical assistance anyway. But the benefit that it offers them is it gets them out of having to pay a spend down. And so the net cost for many of these people is only the $200 or $250 a month that they would have to pay in spend down, but that they don't have to pay, and instead of that, they pay a modest premium, which might be $30, $40, $50 a month.
That's a good thing.
So the net cost of the program is complicated to assess. We spend something in the hundreds of millions on this population, but the difference that this MAEPD access to the program makes is pretty small.
Senator Newman.
I appreciate that we're struggling with getting an answer to this, but where I'm headed is this. Is that the state of Minnesota has DEED, which deals with employment. There are nonprofits that deal with employment that we fund, like Central Minnesota Jobs and Training. Then there are folks out in the private sector, like Doherty Employment, that help people find jobs. And they're all doing the same thing. They are assisting people in finding jobs. What makes, now we have a fourth program, at least that I am aware of, that is designed to help folks find jobs. What makes this program unique such that it could not be handled by DEED or Central Minnesota Jobs and Training or the private sector, such that it merits whatever it is that we may be funding for this program?
Mr. Chair, Senator, DEED is a very close partner and the vehicle by which people are obtaining employment through this program. So this is not duplicative. This is a partnership with DEED and the private sector to find employment for people with disabilities that otherwise would not. So I guess I wouldn't characterize it as duplicative, but it is targeted.
Okay. Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I think the difference is that this program doesn't find employment for people. This program provides health care for people with disabilities when they are employed. And a lot of employers don't want to provide the health care to someone with a disability. And so there would be a barrier to them being hired if it weren't for this program that makes sure they can access health care through a premium-based program. This program isn't an employment agency type of program. This program is a variation on the Medicaid program, and it helps these people be able to retain the Medicaid benefits even though they're employed and have income above what the Medicaid eligibility standard would be. But the caveat is they pay a premium based on their income. And this proposal is raising the premium, and it's also raising the amount of unearned income that would count toward the premium. Mr. Chairman, if I might just ask a question.
Senator Berglund.
The proposal says it can't be implemented before January 1st of 2014, and yet you're asking for an additional staff person beginning 2013, and that additional staff person is in the base. Can you maybe explain why we need an additional staff person, and maybe you could tell us how many people are in the long-term care division at the department?
Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the reason we are asking for the resource, the staff person, prior to the implementation of the premium increase is the loss of the federal Pathways to Employment funding that ceases this year or at the end of this calendar year. And so we want to have a transition to be able to continue to manage this employment program.
Healthcare needs are provided while they're working. Mr. Coleman, can you? What is the qualification to participate in this program? What is the? Is there a defined? Is it an income limit? Is it a disability combination of things that enables a person to qualify for participation in this program?
Mr. Chair. Again, these individuals would otherwise be eligible for medical assistance except for these exceptions. Again, you have to be certified disabled,
right,
to be able to enroll. You have to be employed. You have to find a job in order to buy into this program. Earnings are pretty modest. You have to have at least a minimum of $65 per month. In order to participate. The asset limit is one of the distinctions. The asset limit is higher than otherwise in the medical assistance program. We do allow an individual to have $20,000 in assets in order to purchase health insurance this fashion, and then you have to pay the monthly premium. You have to be current on your monthly premium. And again, the overall goal is to decrease the reliance of people with disabilities on the public sector and encourage and support employment.
Okay, thank you. Senator Sharon.
This is a program that I wish we could extend past the age of 65. 65 is the cutoff for this program. And for those of you who have been here for a while, the prayer that Pastor Don Roberts has written for us on the floor of the Senate is on this program. He's a pastor at a church in Mankato, has Lou Gehrig's disease, is disabled, but on this program is able to retain some assets, has a home, for example, and married. And what happens often to these people is they move to the age 65 and they have to release their assets down to $3,000 in order to be eligible for MA. So, for as an example, Pastor Roberts will have to sell everything while his wife will lose all of her home and everything in order for her husband to be eligible for medical assistance benefits. And if we could extend this in some ways, we could prevent couples from having to face some other, decisions that they might have to make in order to protect assets for the other person in a relationship, which this couple doesn't want to face. They don't want to have to use a legal procedure to terminate a relationship in order to protect one spouse's assets from having to be sold down so that Pastor Roberts can get a health care program for Lou Gehrig's disease without destroying the financial situation of his spouse. That's what this program is about, and that's the kind of people we're trying to help. And I would like to see us extend it past the age of 65. You'll see a bill to that effect, although the funding for it will be a challenge.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sharon, you know, help me with this, but I thought that the spend down for MA was $3,000 for an individual, and if there's a married couple, there's an asset split, and that they can retain their homestead. Am I incorrect on that?
I don't have an answer for that, Senator Newman. I'm not, but Mr. Coleman, do you?
Maybe somebody from the department could help. But I'm not picking a fight here.
No, I understand. It's perfectly. Excuse me, Senator. Sure. I think the clarification is perfectly welcome to all of us. But I do know that the asset issue, income from various things, is an issue for couples, and in order to retain some protections, they are confronted with a decision that they don't want to make because it's based on economics, not on other issues. But someone can answer that question. It would be great.
And just a second, Senator Newman. Mr. Hoffman, did you have an answer for that or some help here?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Newman, the homestead is an exempt asset, so they could keep their home. But your other reference is to a treatment of assets and income, which is applicable when there is a person needing long-term care services. Now, that's not the same as disability. So if this individual is not in need of long-term care services, the benefits of splitting assets and spousal income and asset protections is not applicable.
Thank you. I hope that's helpful. Okay, great. Thank you. Mr. Coleman, are there any further things
Mr.
you'd
Chair,
like to?
That concludes my presentation.
Right. Thank you for coming this morning. Appreciate your being willing to come over early, and thanks for coming back. Members, we're going to, before we take up where we left off on Wednesday, you may recall early in the presentation on Wednesday, we were provided some demographic information that some members had questions about the numbers. It suggested that Mr. Hoffman might be in a good position to respond to those questions. He's also prepared to talk a little bit about the changes in the numbers that are in the February forecast that you have, I think, a copy of that. So we're going to ask Mr. Hoffman just to make a brief presentation on the forecast numbers for enrollment, and then we'll take up. Thank you. Mr. Hoffman.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, looking at the sheet that you referenced, which I believe the members have a copy of.
Yes.
It's headed base forecast for medical assistance basic care. The enrollment numbers are at the bottom of the page, and they show in bold total medical assistance enrollment. We generally talk about enrollment in terms of monthly average enrollment. The enrollment of the elderly and the disabled is split between 50 and 60,000 of that 170,000 that shows there. Between 50 and 60,000 is the elderly group. And enrollment in the elderly part of the MA population is growing very slowly, less than 1% a year. And the reason for that is that we are in, because of the, let me step back a bit. Most, about two-thirds of the elderly individuals eligible for medical assistance are in the program because they have a need for long-term care. Roughly a third are in a nursing facility, and roughly another third are in what we call elderly waiver. And the enrollee population is growing slowly because we are in a lull demographically in the growth of the demand for long-term care from the elderly. It's sort of the lull before the storm, or the lull before the start of the flood, all right? This is the low water before the flood starts to rise. You don't see a lot of demand for long-term care until people get into their 80s. And so it's not until the baby boom bulge starts to approach the late 70s and the 80s that we're going to see a rapidly rising demand for long-term care from the elderly. At this point, the growth is still very slow. The disabled part of the population, which is currently about 110,000 enrollees, is growing at a rate of 3 to 4% per year. And that's been going on for a long time, and that population is driven by federal SSI disability determinations and by our own state SMRT state medical review team determinations. Those are the determinations that say yes, this person is disabled as defined by the federal supplemental security income program, and that's the determination of disability that meets the disability eligibility basis for the medical assistance program. And so the growth in that population, and what you see here is combined, is mostly growth and forecasted growth in the disabled population. The other part of the population, the families with children, the growth that you're seeing there is mostly a function of the weak economy. In the fall of 2008, when we started to have a forecast of a severe I'm trying to think now whether it was fall of 08 or fall of 09. I think it was fall of 08. When we started to have a forecast of a severe economic problem, based on our forecast model, we increased our forecast for enrollment of this group by 15%. And we have subsequently had to raise it a little bit more. So part of that growth is already built into the fiscal 10 numbers that you see here. And the growth from fiscal 10, 440,000 up to 471,000, 490,000 roughly in 12 and 13, that's the leveling off of the effect of the economy on the enrollment in this population.
Mr. Hoffman, with respect to that category, is it the expectation that number would begin to decline back to the 2010 or earlier levels, or historically has that number ever declined, or has it always increased?
It It decreased in the mid-60s, Mr. Chairman, and that had to do with the middle 90s. I'm showing my thinking 96,
okay.
But in the middle 90s, we did have a decrease in enrollment in this population, and it had to do with the strong economy. But over most of the years of the history of this program, it has increased at least a little bit. There were probably 5 years of decrease in the middle 90s. Our forecast would have it basically leveling off in 13, 14, 15 at this point. The effect of the economy on enrollment in this segment is a lagging effect. And so we use in our model a lag structure stretching out up to 12 months. And so it grows, and then it starts to flatten out. We would have it flattening out in 14 and 15 also. You don't have 14 and 15 on this page. But in 14 and 15, we have added an effect from the insurance mandate in the federal health reform law. And we are assuming that insurance mandate is going to drive that enrollment up by about 15% by fiscal year 2015.
So the part of what's going to happen, assuming that the federal law stays in place and doesn't get changed or invalidated, but because of that law, there will be a increase in eligibility for families, which will increase the enrollment number by about 15%. Is that?
Mr. Chairman, the 15% does not assume an increase in eligibility. There are two pieces. This is one of them, and this was in the November forecast. We assumed that we would see an increase in enrollment under current eligibility in the program because of the mandate to enroll. We know that of the people who could be on our program in this group, that typically we probably have no more than 60% of the potential eligibles enrolled. And so we're assuming that the coverage mandate is going to bring additional people into the program. And then in the February forecast, we added recognition that we will have to raise eligibility for the parents. We don't have to raise eligibility for the children because that's already at a level above what is mandated by the federal health care law. So we added that to the February forecast, and that adds another 4% on top of the 15.
Could you also comment a little bit about the adults population on the Minnesota Care side? I guess a couple of things. The Minnesota Care family growth has been, at least in this forecast, pretty substantial growth from 2010 to 2013. Maybe comment a little bit about that. But also the adults, where we're seeing 2011 to 72,000 down to about 40,000, but then also on the MA side, an increase from zero up to 105,000. And just, again, could you review for us what's going on with those numbers?
The 18th, if you look at the lowest line where it has enrollment for adults, that 18,000 is 4 months of startup enrollment averaged over 12 months. For computational reasons, this is how we normally do it. So we would have it We would have enrollment getting up to 45 or 50,000 by June, and then rising fairly rapidly after that. As we transition around 60,000, almost 60,000 people off of Minnesota Care into medical assistance, and we're assuming 27,000 people off of GAMC into medical assistance. So that's the basic forecast is that we're going to have enrollment in the neighborhood of 100,000 in this coverage, while and a little bit higher than that. While the coverage is up to 75% of the poverty level, when it in 14 and 15, when it goes up to 133% of the poverty level, we're forecasting that enrollment of in the neighborhood of 100,000 is going to go up to something over 150,000.
So, in summary, if you look at from the change from 2010 to 2013 that you show on this page, you've got Minnesota Care enrollment increasing by about 35,000, 34,000 enrollment, medical assistance increasing by 175,000. Is this generally the effect of changes in federal law combined with some of the increases in enrollment due to the economy, or just how would you describe those significant changes?
Mr. Chairman, what is affecting Minnesota Care? What's affecting Minnesota Care families with children, I think, is primarily the economy.
It's the economy.
Making more people eligible, causing people to lose jobs and lose health care coverage and come into our program. We haven't assumed any effect of federal law changes on the Minnesota Care side. On the adult without children side, one of the main things affecting it is the end of the old GAMC program, which has been tending to bring people into Minnesota Care, and we would be forecasting somewhat more of that. But then that population is diverted, if you will, into the medical assistance program. And that's the reason why, if you look at the Minnesota Care adults without kids row, the numbers fall in 12 and 13, and they're falling in 12 and 13 because of the medical assistance expansion pulling tens of thousands of people out of that program.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Hoffman, there's been a lot of information floating around about employers dropping dependent care coverage or dropping coverage for children within their plans. Have you seen in Minnesota Care an increase in families with children where the children are the ones being enrolled?
Mr. Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, we haven't looked specifically at that. We haven't noticed any change, but we haven't tried to ask that question. We can check into it and see if we're seeing more cases. We have always had a pretty high number of cases that only have children, because often it's the situation that the parent has insurance coverage of some kind, but either has no coverage available for the kids or would have to pay a high price for it. But we can look into whether the proportion of of cases that has only kids has been changing.
Mr. Hoffman, I appreciate the question, Senator Berglund. I have talked to health underwriters that tell me that in the last whatever the period of time is, year or so since the changes in the federal law, it's not possible to buy an insurance policy for children only in the private market. The insurers no longer offer that because of the changes in federal law that require things that they can't make work economically. And so you're right, there are people who have policies that are their business may offer them that do not include their children. And in the past, they may have gone to the private market and bought a policy for their children only. That's no longer happening. So I think that there might be some shift into this category just from that. Senator Bergel.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the reason that's happening is because the private insurers need an open enrollment period for children to meet the requirement that there not be any pre-existing condition clauses applied to them. And Governor Pawlenty prohibited the Commerce Department from implementing that. I expect you will see the Dayton administration implementing that sometime soon, and then private insurers will offer children-only policies again.
Well, Senator Berglund, I hope that's true. I'm getting mixed information on that. But at any rate, I think it would be interesting to see what the if you can identify if that's been affecting some of the numbers.
Mr. Chairman, we can look at this month by month and see whether we see some sign that this is changing.
Okay. And Mr. Hoffman, you had some other information you wanted to share with us, too?
I believe the members received our document on the forecast changes. This is a document that focuses on the forecast changes. We've been talking here about trends in the program over time. This document takes a different view and focuses on what is changed forecast to forecast. So it has a page with some pages 2 and 3 have sort of headlines on the changes in the forecast, and then the pages following that have a narrative description, program by program, of the reasons for the forecast changes. And then toward the end, starting on page 28, we have a pair of tables for each biennium of the forecast. So on pages 28 and 29, you have a description of the old forecast, which is the November forecast, and the February forecast. And then the following page shows you what the values of the changes are and the percentage changes corresponding to each of the years and for the biennium in that forecast. And the bottom line for the general fund on page 29 is that it's the third row from the bottom, we have a decrease in the forecast of $152 million. Now, $80 million of this comes from the delay of the start of the early expansion. $30 million comes from a higher than expected federal matching rate, and this is all in the narrative. I won't point you to exactly where it is, but it's all there. $30 million in medical assistance comes from our getting a higher federal matching rate for the current quarter than we expected. And so most of the forecast change in the current biennium is from those two things. $80 million for the delay in the start of the expansion, $30 million from the higher federal matching rate. The other changes come a little bit out of medical assistance and uh, some ups and downs in other programs, but those are the highlights of the changes in the current biennium. In the next biennium, 30 and 31, we have hardly any change in the general fund forecast. If you look on, if you look on page 31 at the general fund, total general fund change, it's a decrease of $5.6 million, which is a tenth of 1%. There are a number of things changing here. We have a higher forecast of the cost for the medical assistance expansion. That forecast is between 9 and 10% higher. Because our forecast of Minnesota Care enrollment without the expansion would now be higher, we're assuming about 4,000 more average enrollees, or a 4% increase in the MA expansion. And because of some technical issues and a mistake that we made in building up the forecast for the expansion from the Minnesota Care rates, we changed a number of things here, but that leads to about a 5 or 6% increase in the cost of the expansion. The net for the medical assistance program, the net change about six rows from the top, is an $8 million increase, because there are some decreases in other parts of medical assistance, and there's a pretty big decrease in the chemical dependency fund forecast, because we have done a better job of recognizing effects of the MA expansion on our expected costs in the chemical dependency fund. The MA expansion for adults will pull a significant amount of treatment costs out of the chemical dependency fund, and we hadn't fully recognized those effects in the November forecast. So those are the effect of the delay in the current biennium of the MA expansion saves money in the general fund, but it costs money in the healthcare access fund. And that's the main reason for an increased, it costs around $70 million in the healthcare access fund. And that's the main reason for the change in the current biennium in the Minnesota Care forecast.
Senator Bergman.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Hoffman, has there been any clarification from the federal government about the need to include long-term care benefits in the MA expansion?
Mr. Hoffman.
I only ask this question because we're pretty darn sure it's not going to be included in the minimum benefit set for the 2014 subsidized plan. And so it's always been kind of curious to me why it would be required to be in this benefit set as well.
Mr. Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, I think the story is the same as we told you last, which is we could have a more limited benefit set, but we would have to make exceptions for people with conditions requiring services outside of the limited benefit set in medical assistance. And I have never been able to discern a likely way that that we could save money by doing that? We're assuming when we talk about long-term care services as part of the benefit set, our forecast assumes that we'll have about a 7% higher cost in the MA expansion, mostly because of coverage of personal care services.
Yes, I know.
And the regulations, as far as I've been told, would seem to indicate that we have to make those services available if we limit the benefit to exclude those services, we have to be able to make exceptions for people who meet the requirements of the regulation, which are fairly broad as to the kinds of needs that would trigger that. So I think that's what I know about the situation.
Senator,
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Hoffman, do you anticipate that if we find out what the minimum benefits set at the federal level will be in the spring, that there would be further clarification on this issue at that time?
Mr. Hoffman?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, I believe the regs have been published on this, and I don't know that we can anticipate any change in that issue.
Well,
I can take the question back and see if we can.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Hoffman, the regulations for the minimum benefit set hasn't been published. And, you know, since the early MA buy-in is somewhat connected to whatever the benefit set or whatever the benefits are going to be under the need to have people be insured, it would seem to me there'd be some connection between those two things.
I'm thinking of the regulations about for a more flexible benefit set in Medicaid. I can't pull up the right terminology.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Berglund,
if anyone wants to look into it and get back to me, I appreciate that.
I can check
Mr. Hoffman, thank you.
Are there other questions?
Members, other questions on the forecast numbers? Thank you, Mr. Hoffman, for being willing to come this morning and helping us to understand those. We appreciate it. I would like to, if possible, to return to where we left off on Wednesday, if we can. I think we were looking at page 75 and the change. Thank you for agreeing to come back on Friday.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. Chair Dave Greenman with the Department of Human Services. The proposal on page 75 has to do with the critical access dental program or the payment add-on payment program. It has two pieces to it. The first is a modification to one of the criteria for qualifying for critical access dental payments. In 2010, legislation was enacted that limited what types of clinics or providers would qualify as critical access dental providers, and one of the criteria was that the clinic had to be affiliated with or associated with a University of Minnesota or MinSCU dental academic program. This proposal would revise that to instead say that the clinic or the provider needed to be owned and operated by a academic institution with MinSCU or the U of M. The second piece of the proposal reduces the Minnesota Care add-on payment to the add-on payment level that's currently in place for the MA program, which is a reduction from 50% to 30%.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Bruin?
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Greenman, in regard to the first part of the change, it isn't clear to me whether this is going to further limit access by Minnesota healthcare program participants to dental services. In other words, are the dental providers that would be eliminated from receiving the critical access dental payment then going to stop taking public clients?
Mr. Greenman?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, we don't have the answer to that question. We don't know whether those providers will continue to. We haven't discussed that with them.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Greenman, I think that it's an important question because, you know, if people are claiming to be something to get a payment that wasn't intended for them, that's one thing. But if they are truly serving, you know, 20 to 30% of their patient base as public clients, and they're going to drop those patients as a result of this change, I would think the latter scenario would be very undesirable.
Senator Marty?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Greenman, and following up on that point, I think there was a critical access dentist in southeastern Minnesota who was covering many counties and about the only one who was covering them, and I don't know that the person was affiliated with either U of M or MinSCU. Does that mean that that clinic would not be eligible for the payments?
Mr. Green?
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, there's several criteria that a clinic could meet to qualify to be a critical access dental provider. It includes being a nonprofit clinic, serving being a clinic that's owned by a county or a local government unit. I think there are several other criteria. Clinics that serve high numbers or high volume of low-income clients would qualify as well. We can get that specific criteria to you, what exactly would qualify under this proposal.
Thank you. Senator Sheeran.
Thank you very much. And if you could maybe provide us with a list of clinics that would be eliminated by this, because I think that there's a major that would the federally qualified healthcare clinics that are not owned by the university, and like Open Door in Mankato has a access for very low income, no insurance or MA patients. That's what their caseload is, and they, as I read this, would be eliminated as a critical access clinic if they're currently qualified as one, because they're not owned by university or by MinSCU.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sheeran, I believe if they are a federally qualified health center, they would qualify as a critical access dental provider. Being owned by MinSCU or the U of M is one criteria, one of several in which they could qualify under. For example, you could qualify if you're a county-owned clinic but not affiliated or owned by the U of M or MinSCU. This is just one of the criteria that would qualify a clinic.
So this description is
Mr. Chair and Senator Sheeran, if I could sort of take a crack at this one, I think what Mr. Greenman is saying is there are a number of criteria under which you can qualify as a critical access dental provider. A criteria was added last year which said that if you were affiliated with the university or MinSCU, you could also qualify.
Mm-hmm.
yes. What we're doing here is clarifying that in order to qualify under that particular criteria, rather than being affiliated with, you have to be owned by or operated by. But that's an addition. That's a new category in addition to all the other categories that had previously existed.
Yeah. Thank you. Senator Berglund.
Just to clarify my question, so what I'm trying to find out is, are there some dentists that are using this provision to get additional payment for a few public clients that they might have been seeing? Or, and if that's the case, you know, they weren't really intended to get this. Or are they serving a lot of patients and they're using this criteria to get the add-on payment, but they really are meeting the spirit of what the critical access dental payment was for? That's what my question is.
Mr. Leitz, sir.
Mr. Chair, we'll have some discussions with them. I think our intent in the page was the former Senator Berglund. We want to ensure that it doesn't meet the latter. So we'll have some further discussions.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, real quickly, one more question. The 20% cut, though, the add-on from reducing from 50 to 30%. So, in effect, those that have been providing the care will still continue to get it, but they'll get 20% less reimbursement?
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, that's correct. And I think in the past there's been some confusion about this program. The access to the critical access dental payment is separate from being enrolled as an MA provider. Dentists obviously who are enrolled as MA providers, whether they're critical access dental or not, will continue to be MA providers.
And Senator Berger. Mr. Chairman, I'm sure the second thing in this budget page was in part to help balance the health care access fund. You know, in the past, we've had to reduce, because of the budget, the critical access dental payments in MA, but we didn't have to reduce them in Minnesota Care, so we didn't, because it helps balance out the cut. So when you're looking at how to balance the health care access fund, I know you are looking at that. Perhaps you could look at whether this is really necessary, since it will perhaps cause some providers to drop out of the critical access program.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you guys also just explain, you guys, I'm sorry. could you please explain if there are other stopgaps for dental care besides just this critical access out there for people to pull in? Just out of curiosity, any programs? Is there anything that's being in the works? Just give us an overview on dental care.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, I believe there are programs out there that are not necessarily administered by DHS that encourage dentists to provide volunteer hours. At least they have been in the past. I don't know the status of those programs at this point.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, we'd be happy to follow up with a list of what some of those programs are, if it would be helpful for you.
Mr. Chair,
Rosen,
I would really appreciate that, because and where they serve also, what parts of the state and who they are serving, it'd be great.
Okay.
The next proposal is on page 76. This has to do with payments of claims that come in from people who are duly eligible for Medicare and medical assistance. What this proposal would, in a nutshell, essentially do is limit the payment to providers to the MA payment rate. What we're looking at here is people who receive the Medicare Part B services and who are duly eligible, and those are the services that are provided in doctor's offices, outpatient care, home health services, those things. Currently, what Medicare Part B pays in general, 80% of the cost of the service, up to the 80% of the Medicare allowed payment rate. And we pay the crossover claim, which is basically what remains as a patient's obligation, but because the patient's on MA, we pick up the patient's obligation. Right now, what we do is we pay the additional 20% up to the Medicare-approved amount. What this proposal would do is say that we will pay the provider up to the MA rate. So if Medicare Part B pays 80% and the Medicaid rate is 90% of the Medicare-approved amount, we would only pay 10%. And this is an approach that a number of other states have taken, including Michigan, North Carolina, Wisconsin, Oregon, and Utah.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Hand.
I'm sorry, Senator Sheeran.
Thank you. Could you be as specific as possible about who's included, who's impacted by this?
Sure.
What providers specifically are impacted?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sheeran, we can get a more complete list, but it's It's the providers who are going to deliver the services through Medicare Part B. And so it's going to be the physician services. It's going to be the mental health services. It's going to be services provided in outpatient clinics. So it's a variety of providers who deliver the Medicare Part B services. And the amount of the reduction that they would receive or the impact they would receive would depend on how the MA rate compares to the Medicare-approved amount.
Senator Sharon.
Just for clarification, in those categories of providers, from the physician services to the mental health service provider that might be a psychologist or social worker, are there big differentials in what their payment rate is so that the impact of this is more substantial on one group of providers over another?
Mr. Greenman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, I believe there are some differentials in the payment rates, and those are built in. I think some of those result from the changes the legislature's made in the past to payment rates, MA payment rates for various types of providers. Some providers, I believe, in the mental health area would be exempt from this because of the way their rates are structured. Community mental health clinics, for example, wouldn't see a reduction as a result of this, but certain other types of psychologists and mental health providers would see varying amounts of reductions. But I think it partially at least depends on what type of provider they are and how we currently reimburse them in MA. We do have somebody else here who can maybe help with that.
Senator Sharon.
It might be helpful to have that articulated in writing because that's easier for me to absorb if I can look at it for more than a minute.
Okay. Thank you.
Ready, Scott?
Please.
Mr. Chair, the next item is on page 77. Currently, the department provides incentive payments to managed care plans that expand preventive services for enrollees in our health care programs. In fiscal year 2010, those were well child visits, lead screening, developmental and mental health screening, breast cancer screening, chlamydia screening, and elder care evaluations. We make these payments to reimburse the plans for a portion of the cost of the expanded services, and we do that until the capitation rates themselves can be adjusted to account for the cost of the services. So in a sense, it's a payment that helps cover the cost of these services for the plans until we can adjust the cap rates to actually reflect that. What we're proposing in this budget item is to suspend those payments for from July of 2011 through June of 2013. That produces a biennium savings.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the next item is on page 78. The legislature, I believe 2 years ago, mm-hmm. Defined something called basic care. And it includes a number of categories of services, including outpatient services, durable medical equipment, ambulatory surgical services, lab, eyeglasses, things like physical therapy or occupational therapy, speech-language pathology. We're proposing in this budget item to reduce the rates, do a ratable reduction on the rates paid for those services by a 0.5%. Which produces some biennium savings as well, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Assistant Commissioner Lights, does this include or exclude mental health and primary care?
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, both of those things would be excluded from this category.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the next item is on page 79. Under medical assistance, the transportation services are provided to clients on our healthcare programs to enable them to receive access to the healthcare services that they're that they have under the programs. We do this via ambulance services, special transportation services, and access transportation services. The costs under this particular area of our programs has gone up about 31% between 2003 and 2008. And transportation services have generally been exempt the past several years from reductions that other providers have seen. And so what we're proposing in this budget item is to reduce, to do a 4.5% ratable reduction for those services. This wouldn't affect the volunteer miles or services that are provided, but rather those services that are either ambulance, special transportation, or access transportation.
Okay. Senator Berglund?
Mr. Chairman and Assistant Commissioner, I know this budget page was probably put together before gasoline prices went up so much, but they are predicted to keep going up and to stay up, and, you know, that is one of the major costs that these types, this type of provider has. So I guess I just am wondering if we're going to lose providers with this budget page. And I'm also wondering if you've taken a look at the legislative auditor's report in regard to special transportation and the department's past policies regarding that issue, and if there might be other ways to get savings in this program without doing a rate cut.
Mr. Lights?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, you're correct on the timing of the budget page, certainly. You know, when we put together the page, it was our view that because of the increases that had occurred, we wouldn't have an access problem as a result of the budget page. We'll certainly be examining that in light of things. We have obviously taken a look at the legislative auditor's report on that. We take that report very seriously, and I think are very interested in implementing a great number of the recommendations in there. We'll certainly be examining it for interactions with this budget page, and I think we'll be doing that on a fairly short time track. So appreciate that. We do understand the comments that you're making, and we'll take them into consideration.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I just want to add on to Senator Berglund's comments. We've worked a long time on this area of spending in Department of Human Services, and in order to make certain that the services, and for me in particular in the rural part of the state, when you reduce these and there's a large amount of unloaded miles that are not reimbursed both for volunteers as well as the provider network, you can create the very situation that we were just trying to resolve in the last couple of years. And I know that Senator Berglund has a bill that is going to look at the frequency of the assessments that could create cost savings, that you might not have to do this. And there are other recommendations in the audit report that could provide savings. I know that when we stopped the coordination of the ATS and STS services in the metro area, that the counties reestablished contracts for that with a substantial cost savings by establishing better rates with the provider. So there's a number of places and areas in which I think we can get cost savings without threatening the service providers. And my final request would be that I would, because of my work in this area over the last several years, I'd like to participate as much as possible in your conversations about this if that's workable with you.
Mr. Lights.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Sharon, for that offer. And we certainly would be happy to work with you.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair, the next item is on page 80. Children in our program receive child and teen checkup screenings. The payment rate that we pay for those screenings is set at the 75th percentile of charges for C&T screenings provided during the previous state fiscal year. So in a sense, what happens in the program is that those rates over time increase. We set the rate at the 75th percentile of those charges, and those automatically typically go up year to year. What we've seen over the past several years has been an increase in those rates of about 41%. What we're proposing in this budget page is to basically freeze the screening rates at the October 1st, 2010 amount and not increase them annually for a period of time. We believe that we can do this and not lose any access to the services that are being provided. The rates that are being paid, we believe, are sufficient to ensure that access and to actually produce some budgetary savings while maintaining that access. Next item, Mr. Chair, is on page 81. current law requires that hospital rates that are paid for hospital fee-for-service in our medical assistance program be what's called rebased every 2 years. This process basically incorporates the hospital-specific inflation that's occurred over that time period into the rates that are being paid to the hospitals for services that they provide. The rates were last rebased in 2007 using some 2002 hospital data. The last two legislatures have acted to delay rebasing, both for the 2009 and 2010 biennium, as well as the 2011 and 2012 biennium. So what current law requires is that rebasing would is scheduled to occur on January 1st of 2013. What we're proposing to do is, under this item, is to delay that rebasing for an additional 6 months, which produces a cost savings to the general fund of a little over $100 million, little under $100 million, probably on the page in front of you, for 2013, and some savings into details.
Mr. Lentz.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Lights, is that information that you'll be going off of this again, the 2002, or will there be more current information, hospital data information?
Mr. Lights.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen, so when the rebasing will occur next, I think your question is
will it be using more recent information?
It would, in fact, be using more recent information. I'm not exactly sure if we know the year.
I think we'd be using, Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, we'd be using 2008 data.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the next item is on page 82. The state has operated a program called the Medical Education Research Cost Fund for a number of years, and the purpose of the fund is to really provide funding to clinical training sites for their hosting of medical and dental advanced practice nurses, pharmacists, and others in their training. It helps to offset some of the costs that those programs incur for the work that they do in hosting those residents and other types of providers in training. There's two funding sources for the Merck program. One is funded out of tobacco money that the health department administers. The second is that this relates to this item, a portion of capitation rates that are paid to the managed care plans is carved out prior to going to the health plans. And that money is directed to the health department for purposes of being distributed down to the clinical training sites. The money that's carved out in this item, what we're proposing to do is a reduction in the amount of money that's actually used to be distributed down to the clinical training sites. I think the governor has indicated that of the amount that we had originally proposed, which was about $12.8 million per year, that we would be buying back about half that under the new budget forecast. So the reduction would be, instead of $12.8 million, about $6.4 million on an annual basis, or $12.8 over the biennium. This does result in a reduction to money that would be going down to the clinical training sites, but it does produce savings for the state.
Mr. Chairman and Assistant Commissioner, I'm glad to see that this reduction has been lessened, but it's still an unfortunate budget page, especially because we really need more clinical sites to meet our workforce shortages, not fewer clinical sites.
Mr. Chair, the next item is on page 83. State has had in place a medical assistance hospital surcharge since 1994, and the current rate that surcharge is levied at is 1.56%. This budget item proposes to increase that medical assistance surcharge from the 1.56% that it's currently at to 4.45%. The mechanism here would be to levy that additional surcharge on the hospitals. It's based on their revenues, their net patient revenues, excluding Medicare. Those dollars come into the DHS. We would use a portion of those dollars to increase the rates then paid to hospitals, partially offsetting the surcharge increase. We Under the proposal, we would increase medical assistance fee for service rates to hospitals by 24% from July 1st of 2011 through September 30th of 2012, and then by 18.5% for the next, basically from October 1st of 2012 through September of 2013. The payback of the dollars results in about 44% of the amount that's surcharged being paid back to hospitals in those in that increase in rates.
Mr. Leitz, could you, we had a similar proposal that affecting nursing homes earlier today, wondering if you could provide the same kind of how this would affect hospitals on a case-by-case basis so that we can see the, again, assuming this is going to have disparate effect on different hospitals, and I think members would just like to see how it would affect hospitals in their district. But is that something that could be provided?
It is, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please.
Mr. Chair, the next item is also a surcharge item. This relates to the managed care plans in Minnesota. There's currently, since 1992, a 0.6% surcharge that is charged on health maintenance organizations in the state. This proposal would increase that surcharge from its current level of 0.6% to 4.3%. It would also, and that would be levied on the HMOs in Minnesota. It also creates a surcharge of 4.3% on the county-based purchasing plans in the state, and that would be effective July 1st of 2011. Similar to what I just described in terms of money coming in and being paid back out to the hospitals, we would have a similar mechanism in place for the HMOs and county-based purchasing plans. We would increase the rate for the HMOs by 8.88% from January of 2012 through June of 2012, and then starting in July of 2012, that rate increase would be 3.7%. Similarly, for county-based purchasing plans, we would increase the rate by 10.32% from January of 2012 through June of 2012, and then beginning in July of 2012, that increase would be 4.3%. The aggregate payback to the plans and county-based purchasing plans is around 82% of the total amount that's levied on the surcharge increase.
And Mr. Leitz, again, similarly to the last request, if you could provide how this would affect each of the institutions would be appreciated.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Assistant Commissioner and Mr. Leitz, can you explain how you both, how you landed on 4.3% on the county-based purchasing and the HMOs, and then the 4.45% for the hospitals? I mean, was there a formula that you ended up with, or was a dollar amount you wanted to get to? How did you end up with those figures?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen, what we examined was what the upper limits were with regards to our, from a federal perspective, our ability to levy assessments, and this brings it up close to those limits. So I think the rates that you see are close to where the limits are at a federal level for us being able to do these types of arrangements.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Assistant Commissioner Leitz, you know, I think it's been about 2 weeks ago I asked for how this proposal affects the different plans. Nobody has it yet. I have it in my file cabinet back in my office for how it would have affected them last year.
And Senator Berglund, Mr. Leitz, I think you've indicated you would provide that information to the committee, so we will look forward to seeing that.
Certainly will, and we will get that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the next item would have been page 85. The governor's indicated he would be buying back page 85.
So page 85 is no longer in the governor's proposals?
Correct.
Okay. Mr. Greenman.
The next proposal is on page, I believe it's page 86. This would repeal a eligibility expansion that was first enacted in 2007 and later amended in 2008. This expansion was, we are still awaiting federal approval for the waiver to implement this expansion. Essentially what this did was it created, in 2007, it created a an additional 2 months of medical assistance eligibility for children whose income rises to a level that would require them to disenroll and then enroll in Minnesota Care. And that's the current income limit for kids on MA is 150% of the federal poverty guidelines. So essentially these kids would have been eligible for MA for an additional 2 months before enrolling in Minnesota Care. The other piece of that proposal would have allowed them to be automatically eligible for Minnesota Care, that same population of kids, until the renewal. These would be for kids between the ages of 2 and 18. What this proposal would do is would repeal those provisions and withdraw the waiver request for that particular piece.
Thank you.
The next proposal is on page 87. That, again, would be repealing a eligibility change to Minnesota Care for which we're still awaiting a federal waiver approval. There were two provisions passed, I believe, in 2008 that one of which we refer to as a grace month, and that provides a person with an additional month to pay their Minnesota Care premium before they're disenrolled from the program. I believe right now they have to pay the premium before the first day of the month in which they're receiving their coverage. This would give them till the end of that month to pay the premium. We're proposing to repeal that provision. The other piece of this is what we call the rolling month, which gives them an additional month to submit renewal forms to renew their eligibility, typically income, pay stubs, that kind of information that they need in order to renew eligibility. The legislation would have given them an additional month. We're proposing to repeal that as well and withdraw the waiver request.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Brugler.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Greenman, the buyback list that the governor provided us indicated that they would be buying back changes for Minnesota Care for children. And so this page that you just talked about on page 86, that isn't considered one of those pages.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Greenman.
Senator Berglund, that's not one of the proposals the governor's buying back.
So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Greenman, when you get to it, you'll tell us which one it is.
We will.
Thank you.
We're about to get there.
Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Assistant Commissioner, I suppose it depends on the scope and the size of a waiver, but what is the average waiting period on something like this? Because it's pending, it says here, so what happens if it doesn't come in, and what happens to this budget page and to many other waivers that you have in these budget pages? Mr. Lights.
Mr. Greenman. Chair, Senator, typically, obviously, it depends on how long. The waiver, the amount of time we have to wait for a waiver depends on the waiver and how complicated it is. We have a large package of waivers that we're asking the feds to approve, and we've been waiting for more than a year to get them approved. And that's not that unusual. We're assuming the feds will approve it, and that's why the money to pay for this language is in the forecast, and that's why you get a savings by repealing it. If we don't get the approval, then the money, and if we were to not have repealed this, not proposed to repeal it, and we didn't get the money, the feds didn't approve the waiver, it would just come out of the forecast. There would be a savings in the forecast by not doing this. If we were to allow this language to continue to stay in the statutes and the feds denied the waiver, we would just take the money. It would be a savings to the forecast.
So follow up, Mr. Chair.
Sure. Senator Rosen.
Assistant Commissioner, then can I assume that you do not apply for a waiver unless you're fairly confident it's going to be approved by the feds?
Mr.
Chair, Senator, we apply for waivers when you tell us to.
That's a good answer.
Senator Sharon.
Would you explain to me why you wouldn't
continue to apply for the waiver and delay this funding rather than simply eliminate it? Is there a reason why you wouldn't continue to try to seek a waiver for something that we've already heard and reviewed and saw benefit for, but would delay the payment for it into the future, collect those savings, and allow this process to continue for a while in case we got that waiver?
Mr. Greenman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, I believe if and when we receive the waiver, we would have to implement immediately. We don't have that. The legislation doesn't give us the option to wait and delay the implementation at all.
Senator Hahn. So it would be a matter of our writing some legislation that would suggest that instead of what you're doing would make that possible? If we wrote legislation that said we would direct, as Senator Rosen said, the department to continue with the waiver, but that we would delay implementation, then you would be authorized to do and could do. Would there be a reason to not do that?
I imagine we could save this.
If we think this is a good idea, has cost savings associated with it, that's why we did it in the first place.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, I follow what you're saying, and I think I'd be more comfortable talking to MMB about that to see how they would look at that, but I think that's certainly something we can do.
Mr. Chairman,
I'll let you know.
Senator Brugle.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Greenman, it's been done in the past where we ask for waivers, but we don't fund them pending when they would arrive. Sometimes it takes a long time to get waivers, and you don't want to pay for them for years when they're not actually happening. And, of course, the purpose of some of these waivers were to give continuous coverage to children.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, I wasn't aware that kind of action had been happening in the past.
We did that, Mr. Chairman, Senator Mr. Berglund. Greenman. We did that for assets for farmers, as I recall. And we've done it in other waiver areas as well. Okay.
Maybe we can look into that and see what the. So you're going to talk to MMB and maybe give us some advice on. All right, thank you. Members, we are a little bit past 10 o'clock. I know we've got a few more pages here. I would like to, if possible, see if we can get through those this morning. So if you don't mind, we would continue a little bit. And if you can do that, unless it gets too long. If it gets very lengthy, we'll have to delay. But
hopefully we can get through these, Mr. Chairman. The next item is on page 89. This is the item that the governor has indicated he'd be buying back.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, the next item then is on page 91. This has to do with complying with the federal requirements regarding eligibility changes that were included in the Alternative Care Affordable Care Act, and then previously in the economic stimulus bill a couple years ago, that prohibits states or that would prevent states from implementing more restrictive eligibility standards or methodologies or procedures that were in place prior to a particular date. In the 2009 session, some legislation was passed that limited eligibility, made some eligibility changes, and it was scheduled to be implemented various points along the line that would put us in violation of the MOE requirement, the maintenance of effort requirement on eligibility that the feds had in place. What this provision would essentially do is would delay the eligibility changes until the maintenance of effort requirement sunsets, and that would be for adults. That would be at the point where the health insurance exchange begins operating, which we assume will probably be around January 1st of 2014. For kids, it would be till September 30th of 2019. So that would delay these eligibility changes until then. There's a variety of them, as you can see near the bottom of the page. Some of which you can see what they are. That's, many of them have to do with asset assets and in order to determine eligibility for our programs.
And the, if, why is the effect of the delay an increase in costs? So it seems counterintuitive. If the federal government is changing eligibility, it would seem that it'd be a cost to do that. If we don't do it, it would be a saving. But what is the cost in the delay?
Mr. Chair, these proposals actually produced a savings when they were enacted in 2009. And the result of having of not being able to make the eligibility changes results in a cost to the state because the savings are being taken in the forecast, and in order to not make the changes, we have to incur additional costs.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, my name is Angela Vogt. I'm an executive budget officer with Minnesota Management and Budget.
Could you bring the microphone a little bit closer
so that
we can catch you?
I had been asked to talk about this page because it relates to a fund level transfer between the
health. Which page are you referring to?
Oh, I'm sorry. Page 93, Mr. Chair.
Page 93. And once again, what was your name? I didn't catch it.
My name is Angela Vogt. I'm an executive budget officer with the Minnesota Management and Budget Department.
Thank you. Go ahead, please.
Mr. Chair and members, the piece on page 93, the proposal, is related to adjusting some fund level transfers between the Healthcare Access Fund and the General Fund, the purpose of which is to help balance the Healthcare Access Fund, which was in deficit as of the November forecast. So that's what this piece, this page speaks to. There are a couple of fund level transfers that go between the two funds. One of the large one of which in 2013 was put into place to help fund the early expansion of Medicaid for adults without kids under 75% of poverty. There was a large transfer from the Healthcare Access Fund to the General Fund. Given the deficit in the fund as of the November forecast, that large of a transfer wasn't possible, given the resources in the fund. So what this does is actually reduce that transfer to the general fund by $163 million. The second piece of it is another is to restore another transfer in law. And so the net effect of these adjustments to the transfers is actually $115 million. What it does is it retains resources in the access fund in order to balance the fund.
Thank you. Well, I think that ends the pages, the change pages. I don't see any questions on this from members of the committee. Members, appreciate your coming on Friday. I think starting on Monday, we've gotten requests from folks to provide some testimony on the proposals the governor has made, so we will take testimony from interested parties on Monday on the governor's proposals, and that may extend into Tuesday, but we'll see how many requests we get for comment, and then we have some bills we'd like to hear next week as well. Senator Bergman.
Mr. Chairman, are we going to be hearing anything more about the change pages? I noticed, just for example, there's one change page that adds a new proposal that would be requiring new spending.
Senator Berglund, if we have not heard all the changes, we are going to hear presentations on all the changes. I'm not certain that we've missed some, but are you thinking we have?
Well, it's a change page the governor is making that hasn't been presented that would require new spending, and it's in regard to the North Star proposal.
Senator Bergland, that yes, we will ask for a presentation on that proposal. Perhaps if we can do that on Monday, if that's possible, we'll do that on Monday before we take comment.
I'm just not sure if it's the same proposal they had before or not. So.
Thank you. Thanks for calling our attention to that. And I'm getting a nod here that we could probably get that on Monday, so thank you. Thank you, members. We are adjourned.